This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, how are you today? Great to have you along. Today, we'll see what Meat and Livestock Australia is going to do now that the Australian red meat industry has decided to drop its goal of being carbon neutral by 2030. MLA's been the driving force of this target for years now and has spent over $100 million on various initiatives to try and reach the goal. So what is next for MLA? We'll take a look at that before the news headlines at 12:30 today. And a $355 million Katanning Gold Project in WA's Great Southern region is one step closer to production. We'll get to that a little later in the hour. And then just before one, it's off to Mouche for the results of the sheep market. 12:06 here on the Country Hour on the ABC right across Western Australia, streaming live on the web and on the ABC Listen app. Grain Growers Limited has rejected calls for it to be removed from its duties as a joint representative organisation to the Grains Research and Development Corporation, largely funded by grower levies. At the moment, Grain Growers and Grain Producers Australia are joint overseers to the GRDC and have frequent contact with the GRDC board and executive on a number of issues affecting GRDC operations and strategic objectives. As you heard on the Country Hour yesterday, President of the WA Farmers Grains Council, Mark Fowler, believes the representative organisation role belongs exclusively with Grain Producers Australia and wants Grain Growers Limited to get the boot.
I've addressed this before and I probably don't want to get into too much detail here, but I have been critical of the legitimacy for that organisation to speak on behalf of growers. They have a network, but it is certainly not as well developed as all of the state farming organisations and Grain Producers Australia. And the legitimacy to speak on behalf of growers is really key here. And we have many times in the past few years, acting on behalf of growers, sought to achieve changes in the grains industry and have been met with opposition at the representative organisation level because it's a split role. And we don't think that's really very efficient, and we don't think it's very appropriate. So we would say that that role should be held exclusively by Grain Producers Australia. This situation has persisted for far too long. This is really important to advance policy in the interests of growers, and we would seek the minister and it's the minister's say in this space, to return the situation to what existed prior to the Barnaby-Joyce joint appointment.
President of WA Farmers Grains Council, Mark Fowler, 12:08. Rhys Turton is a farmer from York, around 100 kilometres east of Perth, and he is the chair of Grain Growers Limited. Rhys, what evidence do you have to prove that Grain Growers is a legitimate grower representative group and deserve your joint oversight role to the Grains Research and Development Corporation?
Look, we do obviously direct consultation with farmers. We have 15,000 individual farming members around Australia. We do our major annual policy survey, which has a significant GRDC focus. We have the national policy group, farmers from every state in Australia. We often do micro sort of snap surveys, which we did do on this issue, and we've got a couple of others running on some pretty other important issues in industry at the moment. And of course, we do have our grower engagement offices dotted around the country as well, getting feedback from growers as they travel around.
But you don't charge a membership fee, and it looks like you adopt members, like the time Grain Growers purchased the membership list of WA farmers and basically adopted those members. So under those circumstances, how truly representative are you of those WA growers?
Well, I'd say 15,000 individual farmers as members is very significant. It's a high percentage of all the grain producers in Australia.
But you bought list.
Yeah, but Belinda, we make no apology for being well-resourced. We make no apology for having a professional team. And look, the wise decisions from past directors and management, and actually a lot of grower members who made some pretty smart and bold decisions in the past, have really led to the ability for grain growers to have longevity, to continue professionally and efficiently representing farmers all around Australia at every level.
But if you're going around buying lists from other farm groups, how do you truly claim that you represent 15,000 growers around the country?
Well, the fact is we do, and what it's allowed us to do is offer free membership. It gives financial relief to members without compromising on the service, the representation, the respect, or the ability to get results, really.
And if you were to contact those growers and ask them to pay a meaningful membership, you know, sort of several thousand dollars a year, how many would pay?
I'm not too sure, Belinda. We don't have to do that, so we've never done it. As I say, the smart decisions from the past and the fact that we're well-resourced means we don't have to send a bill to members, and it allows us to do that particularly important work to the best of everybody's ability.
But by paying a membership, doesn't it make you more accountable? And, you know, every year that annual renewal of membership comes up, so members are making a conscious decision whether to renew or not.
Belinda, we are totally accountable to every member that is a member of Grain Growers, I can assure you. And I guess I just take the legitimacy question by measuring the number of members that are running out the door, and that's actually none because the membership is growing. So I think that's a good endorsement of our legitimacy as an organisation.
It's not just WA Farmers Grain Section President Mark Fowler sort of questioning the legitimacy of Grain Growers to be a joint representative organisation to the Grains Research and Development Corporation. The WA Grains Group has been in touch with me to say the same thing. Pastoralists and Graziers Association, which is not a member of either grain growers or grain producers, all agree that having two national bodies overseeing the GRDC doesn't make sense. So is this a case that everyone else is wrong and you're right?
Seems to be a strong WA focus here, Belinda, given we are national organisations, that both ROs are national organisations. But look, just in terms of legitimacy, I think you could ask DAF, DFAT, the Treasurer, the Minister for Ag, the Minister for Trade, hundreds of participants that have completed our capacity building and leadership programs, farmers who we're currently assisting with unrealised capital gains tax issues. It's huge and there's hundreds of them. Work in bioenergy, thought leadership work around fuels of the future, carbon and climate work and sustainability. None of those members are telling us that we're an illegitimate organisation. And I go back to what I said originally. We were handed the responsibility by government, which I think by default gives us a legitimacy. We take it seriously. We consult. We focus on the role and we don't get hung up on commenting on joint arrangements.
How is it that you're so well funded?
So some time ago, there was a number of bulk handling assets purchased by what was the Grain Growers Organisation of the time. That was spun into what is now known as Grain Corp, and Grain Growers sold its shares in Grain Corp at the time to focus on advocacy rather than being a publicly listed company. And that's where the bulk of the investment money came from, which at the time was about $90 million. And that has been grown to something significant more than that presently.
So all the roles within Grain Growers are paid roles, unlike sort of WA Farmers or PGA, they're voluntary roles in those key positions.
No, there's paid roles in WA Farmers. I was WA Farmers president and I was paid for that role. But yes, roles within Grain Growers are paid or expenses reimbursed depending on your role in the organisation.
Do you believe that has an effect on the policy decisions that are being made at Grain Growers?
No, I don't. I think it gives a professional opinion. I think it allows professional people to come into the organisation and be involved in policy development.
What's your position on the GRDC levy? Because over the last couple of weeks, we've heard that, you know, there's some calls to put that levy on hold for a couple of years and sort of run down some of the reserves or maybe even halve it for some time because there is so much money in the kitty at the GRDC.
Yeah,
do you support that?
Have indeed, Belinda. It's been our focus for at least the last 12 months. And I was particularly keen to update growers today on just what we have been provided in terms of GRDC's management of the reserves, and I think any levy discussion, and importantly to assess the RD&E capacity and ability that will inform future investment decisions. And believe me, as one of the two oversight organisations, I'm not here to defend GRDC. Our role is to ensure they're working effectively and investing money wisely on growers' behalves. And I'm actually of the opinion that they could communicate their value proposition somewhat better than they have been. It's absolutely critical that GRDC prove that grower levies are wisely spent and helping everybody's farming business. And they could demonstrate that in a more practical and tangible way, I have no doubt. So just to take you on that journey of the last 12 months, as that reserve grew last year, we called for some additional information. We started putting the acid on GRDC. We wanted to explore if additional investment would benefit the industry, or whether there would be an opportunity to consider levy rates. And particularly important to us was a review into the capability and resources available to undertake grains research, development and extension. So both the ROs agreed that a professional organisation would be engaged to undertake a review into the GRDC, and that has been called the Right Size RD&E Review. And the idea of that is to better inform modelling around the levies and also to assess capability and capacity that, again, will inform those investments going forward. That has been completed. Both ROs will have the opportunity for a presentation on that this month. So we're actually reserving our decision on levy rates until we have reviewed that quite extensive document. We can then go back to our members and consult, get the opinions and see whether we need to have a levy rate discussion or whether that research that has been undertaken on behalf of the industry will have other options in it.
And what sort of a fight will you put up to retain your joint representative role to the Grains Research and Development Corporation?
I'll leave that up to the Minister to decide, Belinda. That's the government's call, not ours. We do the job very professionally. We do it with great responsibility. And if the government decide one day they don't need us or want us, so be it.
Rhys, great to have you on the Country Hour. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Belinda. Cheers.
Rhys Turton, he is Chair of Grain Growers Limited and he's also a WA farmer. He's based just near York, about 100 kilometres east of Perth. It is 17 past 12.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
And just in addition to that, I did contact Julie Collins, the Federal Agriculture Minister's office, just to see whether she would be keen to take a look at that oversight role, that joint oversight role between Grain Growers Limited and Grain Producers Australia, that joint oversight role to the Grains Research and Development Corporation. The question's still there. I haven't heard back, but her office did get in touch to say they'll get back as soon as possible. 18 past 12. We'll check in with the news headlines at half past 12. First, though, Australia's red meat industry has dropped its goal of being carbon neutral by 2030, saying it's just not achievable. So where to next for Meat and Livestock Australia? Because MLA has been the driving force of this target since 2017 and says it spent over $100 million on various initiatives to help the industry reach that goal. It's today released its latest five-year strategy, which includes a noticeable shift away from the CN30 target, which is the carbon neutral by 2030 target. MLA Managing Director Michael Crowley says in the last year they've consulted heavily with industry before finalising this latest strategy.
I think through the course of that 12 months, we saw that there was concern about retaining a goal that all of the data says that we weren't going to achieve carbon neutrality by 2030, despite all of the great investments that we have made and continue to make that will drive our net position in a positive way. So we, as a company, decided to remain aligned with the meat industry strategic plan, Red Meat 2030. And through that discussion with the industry representatives, there was a decision made to move from CN30 to aligning with the national net zero ambitions that didn't exist when CN30 was first envisioned.
Michael, you said MLA consulted heavily to get to this moment. Is that what was lacking perhaps back in 2017 when CN30 was first born?
Well, I think that 2017 was a very different time in that we saw this as a real emerging trend that our industry would need to respond to. And the language in 2017 was the industry can be carbon neutral by 2030. It changed the investment landscape significantly when CN30 became part of the meat industry strategic plan, which commenced in 2020. That was really when we were able to scale up the investments, particularly through the MLA donor company, which has been about 80% of the investment.
Yeah, sorry, Michael, just on the question, do you think the red meat industry wanted that back in 2017? Just going off a few conversations I've had with cattle producers this morning, they just felt no one was actually asking for it back then.
I think it was one of those insight-led visions that we could be carbon neutral by 2030. It was disruptive. It was designed to be disruptive. And it was through the development of Red Meat 2030 that was where the discussions were held about whether it becomes part of the industry plan. And it was adopted as part of the industry plan after that initial disruptive period.
Has it been MLA's biggest R&D spend over recent years?
It hasn't. I would say our genetics program is the largest proportion of our investment. We've certainly seen more growth in our sustainability investments, particularly around CN30. We've invested over $100 million over the last 5 years, but we've also scaled up our investments in productivity-driven investments. We've really scaled up, more than doubled our investment in producer adoption, and trying to move from from R&D into adoption and commercialisation across a whole range of investments we make, from genetics through the on-farm production system, objective measurement technologies and beyond.
You mentioned there's been about $100 million spent on this target. I've got a press release from MLA in 2023, Jason Strong, saying that since 2017, MLA has invested about $200 million and we're looking to invest a further $150 million.
So I think there was maybe it's a slight adjustment in the language, but I've looked at from 2020 to 2025 was over $100 million of investment.
So perhaps since 2017 it could be close to $200 million?
Oh, I don't think it was that high, Matt. Yeah. There was certainly, we identified very early on that investment required to get to CN30 would be closer to $250 million. But we now have the zero net emissions for agriculture, CRC, getting off the ground. Mm. And the livestock component of the CRC lines up directly with the key priorities in our roadmap to get to CN30. So we're really only here in 2025 getting the additional leverage, and ability to move from R&D into adoption and commercialisation in this space. So we've done the heavy lifting on getting those investments off the ground. And then I think that we are moving very much into adoption and commercialisation of the technologies that have been developed to date. And our core funding that we'll be responsible for outside of the CRC will focus on the biogenic methane cycle, productivity-driven sustainability investments, as we build on methane as a trait in our genetic evaluation, the feed supplements that have been developed across a whole range of technologies that are looking really promising, as well as the
productivity
on
that
components.
Though, what do you think the appetite is for feeding seaweed to cattle now that this target is no longer there?
I still think there's going to be strong demand from supply chains and customers that are really wanting to demonstrate significant progress on reducing emissions of their supply chain. And we will continue to measure under the National Greenhouse Gas Inventory Australia's red meat and livestock contribution to the National Greenhouse Gas Inventory. So we are still committed to measuring our progress every year, as we have done through CSIRO's report against the 2005 baseline. So there will still be very much that customer pull-through demand for these technologies moving forward.
Last week, John McKillop from the Red Meat Advisory Council told the Country Hour that MLA now needs to come up with an intensity model and that you've got 12 months to do this. Can you explain to us what that is and what it might look like?
There are two key strategic plan KPIs under our environmental sustainability area. So one of them is measuring our contribution against the National Greenhouse Gas Inventory, which is our net zero number, and we'll continue to report that. The other component, when we look at productivity-driven sustainability and having a more efficient supply chain and production system, is measuring emissions intensity per kilo of production. So we will be developing a baseline for that measure and continuing to report our emissions intensity moving forward and making meaningful progress in reducing our emissions intensity per kilo of production. To me, that is quite a significant step forward in recognising a more efficient production system, more fertile animals, more feed efficient, reducing days to slaughter, getting animals to market faster, will all contribute to the emissions intensity number.
Meat and Livestock Australia's Managing Director Michael Crawley speaking to Matt Brann about the latest five-year strategy, which is hot off the press, just been released. It includes a noticeable shift away from the previous target of being carbon neutral by 2030. And you can find MLA's new five-year strategic plan via its website. What do you make of it? Your thoughts on that shift of a plan? What do you think of the money that's already been spent on R&D trying to achieve that carbon neutral goal? This on the text from Malcolm in York. So the MLA has spent $100 million on this climate scam, which most of their members never believed in. The old saying of a fool and his money are soon parted seems quite apt. When will others listen to farmers and come to the same conclusion? Asks Malcolm. The text is 0448 922 604. If you want to be part of the conversation this afternoon, 26 past 12. Well, one organisation that's been critical of how Meat and Livestock Australia spends levy payer funds is grass-fed cattle industry group Cattle Australia. Chief Executive Chris Parker is stepping down. Dr. Parker has been in that role for about a year and a half, but has decided to take on a part-time role with the organisation. He says Cattle Australia will keep fighting for all the things he knows are important to producers, including how levies are spent.
Well, I think there's been a number of issues, not least of which is the continual pressure the industry is under from environmental groups. I see that as ongoing. Of course, we had the discussions and eventual scrapping of the biosecurity levy that the government was going to put in place. We continue to advocate to ensure the continued prosperity and success of the live cattle industry. All of those things remain important priorities for Cattle Australia, and certainly were important priorities for me earlier on. But the other thing, of course, is that, you know, part of our role is to hold meat and livestock accountable for the manner in which they spend levy fare funds. And I think we've been able to develop a much better relationship and a much, I think, more respectful relationship where MLA understand our role far better. I think we have a much better influence over that than maybe what the industry's had in the past.
I understand there's a levy review to be undertaken at Cattle Australia.
Well, certainly it's no secret. Gary Edwards, our chair, announced talked about that at the NTCA conference earlier this year. And really, we see this as the time is right to be looking at the manner in which the industry levies itself to ensure its prosperity going forward. I mean, the organisation doesn't have a particular view about the quantum other than we need to be looking at this and make sure certainly the distribution of that levy is in line with what we need as an industry to support ourselves going forward.
You mentioned pressures on industry relating to environmental and climate concerns. Last week, the red meat industry did announce that it was abandoning targets to become carbon neutral by 2030. They said it's just simply not possible. But industry, the council will be looking at setting new targets. Do you think this was the right move by industry to abandon this target? Is it the right move for industry and for the climate?
The carbon neutral target was meaningless. You know, I mean, it had some had some value in an aspirational sense when it was put in place 5 years ago, but it's a target that's not really achievable. But I think what's important to focus on here is what we are going to do, and that is we're going to continue to contribute towards the government's ambitions to reach net zero, and the industry is an important part of that. I mean, we are owners or managers of over 50% of the landmass. We are part of the solution to this, and I think that's a component that we really need to keep in front of governments, and so they will understand our role and what we can actually do in this space, which is pretty significant when we own a large amount of the mitigation measures for greenhouse gases.
Outgoing Cattle Australia Chief Executive Dr. Chris Parker speaking to Fiona Broom. He's been in that role since November 2023. Next week, he's going to be replaced by former CEO of the Northern Territory Cattlemen's Association, Will Evans. 29-1, Jade Barker in the studio with the news headlines. Hello.
Hi, Belinda. WA's police commissioner says officers rely on intel from community to disrupt organised fights and street violence. It comes after the two men who killed Perth schoolboy Cassius Turvey in Middle Swan in 2022 were sentenced to life in prison. During the sentencing, the Chief Justice told the court he was concerned violence has become commonplace in Perth's eastern suburbs. When asked what was being done to disrupt the culture, Commissioner Cole Blanche told a budget estimates hearing in Parliament, officers can only help when they're informed. Property analysts say house prices will continue to rise as interest rates go down. The latest data from property research firm Cotality shows a fifth straight month of growth, with national home values up 0.6% in June and 1.4% over the quarter. And the company behind a proposed gold mine in WA's Great Southern has acquired 258 hectares of farmland and native vegetation in a deal worth $1.1 million. Perth-based Mendelian Metals is progressing feasibility studies and permitting activities for its Ravensthorpe Gold Project. The proposed underground mine would require the clearing of up to 80 hectares of native vegetation. More news coming up at 2 o'clock.
Jade, thank you so much for that update. 28-1.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio WA.
Earlier in the hour, you heard from Rhys Turton, who is the chair of Grain Growers Limited. Got to get these names right, don't I? Rhys Turton, chair of Grain Growers Limited. And he was defending the group's role as a joint representative organisation to the Grains Research and Development Corporation, saying it is a legitimate grower representative body and it deserves its place at the table in that oversight role to the GRDC. In response to that on the text, Michael says Grain Growers Limited is a New South Wales-centric organisation that is backed by a group of New South Wales farmers. Grain Growers Limited free membership was used to achieve membership from across Australia to attempt to add legitimacy to gain federal government support and funding. Mark Fowler, who's the president of the WA Farmers Grain Section, is 100% correct with his comments and is representing WA and Australian growers in the best way. Thank you, Michael. This on the text too, another minnow group with no clout, Grain Growers Limited. Thank you. And this from Rob, who says, first, it is somewhat disingenuous for Grain Growers Limited to claim membership when most members were adopted. Even kids at college level were adopted and most likely never bothered to drop claimed membership. Second, it would appear extremely clumsy to have two representative organisations doing a review of the Grains Research and Development Corporation, then each developing a response to the review. Thanks, Rob. A few texts coming through. Hopefully I can get to more of them between now and the news at 1. The text is 0448 922 604. 26-1. Let's make our way to the Bureau of Meteorology now. Caroline Crowe is with you. Caroline, let's take a look across the Southwest Land Division.
Good afternoon, Belle. Our main feature for the next 4 days through the Southwest Land Division is a cold front that's going to move through later on Wednesday and into Thursday. So prior to that, for the remainder of today and sort of the first part of tomorrow, it's sort of just some chance of a light shower through the southwest land division. Lots of cloud around, more high cloud through those northern parts, but could get sort of just that very lightest drop, but not much in it. As you progress sort of a little bit more to the lower west and the southwest, there is chance of a bit more of a shower, and that high level cloud through the central west we will see thicken up a little bit during the evening as well, which then could bring a bit more of a shower. But it's really going to be later in Thursday and later in Wednesday and overnight into Thursday with this cold front moving through. So the cold front's expected. It's quite a north south standing type of cold front, so is expected near the west coast late afternoon on Wednesday, early evening, so around sort of the Geraldton, Durian Bay area down, right down to the southwest capes. That's where we'll see the leading edge of it, and it will gradually move through overnight. So by about midnight on Wednesday, we're looking at the shower line reaching around the Shark Bay area through Meriden and down towards Ravensthorpe. So southwest of that line is the shower area. Most of it is going to be around that west coastal region between so Durian Bay through to around Walpole is on Wednesday, 10 to 20 millimetres around the southwest capes might get a little bit more, and then just some isolated falls, possibly 30 to 40 millimetres. And then as we progress a little bit further north and east from around the Geraldton area down through to Collie and Albany is around the 5 to 10 millimetres, and then it's gradually going to sort of ease as we progress towards that line that I mentioned from that 5 millimetres through to 1 millimetre as you get out towards Meriden for Wednesday. On Thursday, the cold front's going to continue moving through the southwest land division, so it sort of exits east of the southwest land division, shall I say, by early afternoon. So most parts of the southwest land division should see some sort of shower activity. It's going to continue sort of around that 10 to 20 millimetres along the west coast. Most of that will be that overnight period into Thursday morning. Then from around the Geraldton through to Dalwallinu area towards Meriden, back through to Collie and then around towards the Burren Bay area, getting to 5 to 10 millimetres, and then the remaining parts of the southwest land division will be less than 5 millimetres. So Southern Cross possibly 1 to 5 millimetres of rain with that cold front moving through. And then as we progress into Friday, Bell, that system's going to continue moving east, so most of the shower activity will be along the Esperance coast and the southeast coastal district, where the Esperance area coastal parts could see 5 to 10 millimetres, and then around less than 5 millimetres getting inland from the Esperance coast. But otherwise, it's generally on an easing trend on that Friday, where the showers will contract towards the coastal parts and sort of just be that coastal areas coming into Saturday. Associated with the cold front as well, there will be some thunderstorms on Wednesday. It's going to be sort of most likely, so mostly with that leading edge and as the cold front moves through. So Wednesday it will be confined towards those west coastal parts, could be quite gusty. Possible slight chance of getting some hail from the thunderstorm as it moves through. And on Thursday, those thunderstorms will move a little bit further inland, so the west coastal districts mostly, but possibly get a thunderstorm as far inland as Morowa, Payne's Fine, getting into Dalwallinu area as well. Through the next couple of mornings with the cloud and the rain, it will be a little bit warmer, but coming into Saturday morning, we could see some colder temperatures, which then could lead to some frost through that Saturday morning, Bell. And then just looking a little bit further afield after this cold front, it does look as though at this point in time that we're going to have a stronger cold front and weather system move through the Sunday-Monday period.
Oh, that sounds promising. What's it looking like now in terms of rainfall?
So I'm going to say sort of similar at this point in time. This cold front does look a bit stronger, particularly from a wind perspective. So sometimes as you've got, although the system does push through the whole southwest land division, sometimes they can, the wind can push those showers through a little bit quicker. So you might get a few more showers, but the rainfall might be similar as a slower cold front. Although heavier, it pushes through quicker.
All right, well, we'll keep an eye on it anyway. How is it looking across northern and eastern parts of the state?
So at this stage, Belle, typical dry season conditions through northern parts. The easterly winds have started to ease, so they're not as fresh and gusty as what has been experienced over the previous few days and last week. Still some cold mornings, though. Newman and Wiluna inland parts, 2 to 3 degrees, and heading sort of southeast from that area there towards Warburton and Giles, quite cold temperatures, so areas of frost, and we'll still see that the next couple of days. But as the cold front moves through sort of more that later or getting into probably more Thursday through getting up into the West Pilbara area through the Gascoyne and the Goldfields, we'll start just some light showers through those areas. And as it extends further east as well, we'll get an air mass change. So those cooler temperatures should rise a little bit and not see so much frost as we progress after Thursday and Friday with that air mass change. Minimum temperatures through the Kimberley have also been a little bit below average as well. Horse Creek and Fitzroy were 5 and 6 degrees through the area there. So quite cool though for this time of the year at the moment. And then as we progress into Friday, that shower area through the Gascoyne and the Goldfields and getting into the Euclid will gradually contract towards the south coast and ease Friday and Saturday.
Thank you so much, Caroline. 19 to 1, Richard Hudson in the studio with the rainfall figures.
I didn't think it got to 5 degrees in Halls Creek. Wow. As Caroline mentioned, very fit, normal conditions for the northern and eastern forecast districts at the moment. It is the dry season and there was not a scrap of rain recorded anywhere at all. In the southwest land division forecast districts, though, in the central west, Durian Bay topped it with 2. In the lower west, lots of places had 2 to 3 mils. Above that was just Gingin West recorded 6 and Rolly Stone 7, Woodridge Estate 10. And then a bit more in the southwest, Acton Park 14, Bailing Up 7, Boyne Up North 11, Brunswick Junction 5, Bunbury, Cape Leeuwin and Cape Naturalist 8, Busselton 23, Capel 19, Chapman Hill 17, Kawarram Up 8, Darden Up 6, Donnybrook 15, Doyle Road 12, Ferguson Valley 9, Happy Valley Alert Station 7, Harvey and Hentybrook 5, Jindong 19, Carriedale 13, Margaret River 12, Newlands 15, Paindale Alert Station 16, Perivale Orchard 10, Ravenscliff Alert Station 6, Rosabrook 5, Scott River 9, Thompson Brook and Warner Glen recorded 14, Vass 15, Windy Harbour 8 and Yungarilla 12. In the southern coastal region there was no rain at all, and then in the central wheat belt there was nothing, and in the Great Southern the most was 3 mils at Chaming Up and Quail Up, but nothing more. There's been some pretty wild weather affecting the New South Wales coast at the moment, though. There's a system just off the coast bringing all sorts of surf and winds and rain. A severe weather warning's in place, and they're expecting a fair bit to be happening probably in the next 24 hours or so. New South Wales SES has already issued a couple of watch and act notices. This is stay indoor warnings, one for the Sydney coastline and the second for the south coast. A flood watch is current for parts of the mid-north coast, Hunter, Hawkesbury, Nepean, Sydney, Illawarra coast and snowy catchment areas. That's a big area. They've had more than 900 calls made to the New South Wales SES. That's just in the last 24 hours. Evacuation centres are being prepared and flash flooding is expected between Newcastle, Sydney and Illawarra. I am sure a lot of farms are going to be affected by this system because, as you know, some have already copped a lot of rain this year and this will just be topping it up, unfortunately.
Richard, thanks for those details. 17 to 1. Shortly, taking a look at the Katanning Gold Project in WA's Great Southern region, one step closer to production. So we'll get the latest details on that project shortly. First, one of the stars of the ABC TV show Master Dogs, Princess Annie, died suddenly of a brain aneurysm this week, age 5. Annie was crowned the Season 1 Muster Dogs Champion back in 2022. The Kelpie was laid to rest at her home near Claremont in central Queensland with a family gathering just early yesterday morning. It has been such a difficult time for owner and handler Frank Finger, who also lost his wife just last week. He says no one in the family was the same after that, including Princess Annie.
She's a classic example of what you can get from a dog if you treat them with kindness. And that's what a lot of dogs need. They still need a little bit of discipline. And I always say that dogs don't care what you know until they know you care. You can be the best trainer in the world, but unless you care for that particular animal and have that bond, you won't get what we had.
And can you tell us about your bond with Annie?
Well, we started at a very young age. I took her everywhere with me, and I still was right up until the other day. Wherever I went, every day she was with me. And if we weren't working cattle, she was still with me. She rode in the vehicle with me, and we were just together all the time. But it's an eye bond. Wherever I walked, when we're doing dog skills, and she sits on the back of a bike all day just waiting for her little bits that she used to do, I'd look over, and wherever I was, she'd be following me. If she wasn't asleep, she'd go to sleep sometimes, but she'd be following me. Our last travelling job was to be this week. We were going back to the Atherton show for the third time. And when we got home from that, I had that worked out at about 52,500 k's with travelled in 4 years.
You must have an outpouring of messages from people around the country. Annie really made an impact on not just rural people, but those in the cities too. What are some of the reflections that you're having at this time?
First of all, I'm just overwhelmed by the support. And I was keeping a track of things on Facebook until yesterday. And when you fellas put that up and there's 30,000 likes and nearly 1,000 comments or something, I'm just not in the frame of mind to keep reading them. I can only do a little bit at a time, but I'm just overwhelmed by the support. I just look back on my time as Annie, as now all I can do now is be thankful for the time I had her. And if she had to go, it must have been meant to be.
Was that a unique bond? You've spent your life around dogs.
Yeah, it was unique, yes. Mainly, you know, truthfully, we were going on national TV. So if I'm asked to do something, I always try to do my best. And I'm not a believer in taking something on unless you do it properly. She was an easy dog to train, an easy dog to love. She never, ever done anything wrong. She wasn't something that would chase chooks or chew things up or have annoying habits. But once again, I think that's because you just put in that bit extra. The difference between an ordinary dog and an extraordinary dog is the extra you put in. So ordinary becomes extraordinary, and that's what she was. Annies are born and not bred. You can't set out to breed a dog like her. They just turn up one in the litter now and again, and I was just very fortunate. I've had two in my time of brilliant dogs. Like, I've got good, all the other dogs are good dogs, but just that little extra brilliance that they just know what's happening, you know. And I think part of her death was brought on. My wife, Kathy, died last week on Wednesday, and she hasn't been the same since. The grandchildren and my family can see when they come to the house that she's not the same. She lives out the front of the house. We've got a fully closed in, like a fence where she can't get out, just a little area of lawn. It comes up onto a tiled lean-to area. And she lives in just a dog crate that we fly in the planes with. And I made that her home because she was getting to not like flying on a plane. So I made the crate her home so she didn't get suspicious or nervous when she seen me put it in the car. She just hated flying in the cargo carriage of a plane. I think when we get out to wherever we're going, her heart would be beating, and she was just, as soon as we'd go back to the airport and wherever she is, wherever we were, you could just see she was unsettled. So that's why I had her there and in the biggest crate I could get. And she just, since Kathy died, she's just lived in there with the door open, doesn't come to meet anyone. She wouldn't understand what happened, but she can feel that we're unsettled and unhappy. And she sort of, that's her reaction to that. And she was fretting.
The name is special. Could you tell us about this?
No, that was my mother's name. And I knew if I called her that, I would have a bond just the same as I had with my mother.
With Annie, you had some incredible experiences going to different shows as well, or taking Annie to aged care facilities too. During this time, is there, I guess, reflections maybe about human nature as well, when you spend time with a pet that makes people happy? I can imagine you'd see the best in people too.
You do. When we go to Atherton, we go to the home there too. There's 140 people there, and they just wait each year for us to come up, and that was as important as going to the show. Like, we didn't charge for it. We just went there and spent a couple of hours, and the show committee encourage any acts or something they have to the show, if they can go there and do a little bit of entertainment, and we would just take the dogs. And the first year we went there, we came away with bags of homemade jams and pickles and things that the residents had made for us, yes.
Well, you've got a feel for Frank, don't you? What a week. His wife, Kathy, dying last week, and everyone obviously feeling the effects of that in the family, and even his Kelpie, Princess Annie, who could just sense that grief in the house, and Princess Annie dying suddenly of a brain aneurysm just this week. Princess Annie and Frank, stars of the ABC TV show Muster Dogs, and he was speaking to Jeremy Jones. 10 minutes to 1.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio, WA.
We'll head off to Mushay for the results of the sheep market shortly, just before the news at 1 o'clock. First, though, a $355 million Katanning Gold Project in WA's Great Southern Region is one step closer to production. Ausgold has just finished its definitive feasibility study for the project, which is about 30 kilometres from the Katanning town site. Ausgold Executive Chairman John Dorwood is optimistic the project will go ahead and is confident it can benefit the broader community.
We've had a lot of interaction with the Shire of Katanning, who've been very supportive. They're very keen, I think, to see the economic base of Katanning and the district grow and diversify. We think this is an ideal opportunity for it. So they've been working with us closely on that to identify impacts and anything that might arise and how we can best deal with that. So this project will employ around 350 people full-time when in production. There'll be 250 jobs essentially during construction. So, you know, I think there'll be quite a lot of opportunities for potentially for employment. We'll also draw quite widely in the broader Western Australian community for workers and people with the skills and experience. But I also think it's a great opportunity for local businesses to be able to supply services to us. I mean, we'll be bringing a lot of people to the district and they all need to be fed. We'll have a lot of equipment that needs to be serviced, et cetera, like that. So we think that from a business perspective and an economic activity, you know, it's got a lot to offer. You know, and we've been also keen to make sure that, you know, the benefits of the project are shared broadly within the community. And we've been starting to support, you know, in a relatively modest way, local community groups.
You mentioned construction jobs at 250 and operational jobs expected at 350. Are you expecting these positions will be residential or fly-in, fly-out, or a bit of a blend?
I think a bit of a blend. So our initial plans are that we will build an accommodation village on the outskirts of Katanning. That's the message that we've heard from the Shire, is that they didn't really want us to build a village, accommodation village, out of the mine site, you know, 30 kilometres outside of Katanning. They wanted it to be integrated somewhat with the community, have people out shopping, doing things in the community when they're not working. So we heard that, and that's what we're working on with them. So we will build our own accommodation. It's not like we're going to suddenly need to house a bunch of people in the housing stock in Katanning. We'll build that accommodation ourselves. And then we expect a fair portion, a large portion of that will be drive-in, drive-out. But then there'll also be a residential component. I think that there will ultimately be staff who will look to move to Katanning with their families, have kids go to school, and, you know, mum and dad come home from work each day. That's pretty rare in the mining business, certainly today, where, as you say, fly-in, fly-out's the dominant model. So, you know, I think it's going to be a bit of a blend. Initially, we'll look to provide that accommodation ourselves because we don't want to come and, you know, be competitive with people who are looking to get into the housing market themselves.
How much gold are you expecting to extract from this project, John?
So over the life of the mine, we produce about 1.14 million ounces of gold. That's what's based on our reserves. Typically what you see with gold projects is that they will go longer and produce more than what you initially. This is based on the drilling that we've done to date. Once we get into the mine and continue exploration, it's natural that we would expect to find more. At the moment, we will be producing, you know, for 10 years, but I think it will go a lot longer. We'll be producing around 140,000 ounces of gold per annum, which is a substantial amount of production. And that will enable us to continue investing to continue expanding that mine life.
John, how much investment will this project need?
So our initial estimate of the upfront capital cost is $355 million. It's a substantial investment. It's a significant business. We're in the process of talking to banks and prospective lenders about and investors about helping us fund that. So we will be looking to raise that financing sort of probably mostly early next year and look to start construction around the middle of next year, 18 months construction period, and then producing with that goal of producing before the end of 2027.
So you've wrapped up the definitive feasibility study. What's happening now? What's next?
We now move into a process called detailed engineering and what's called a FEED study, which is front-end engineering and design. So that's really the sort of the detailed planning and design of the project. We'll be moving on financing as well. And then the key part too now is really around permitting. So we have to apply to a range of government agencies to get permission to build and operate the projects. That's a very rigorous process, both at the state level in Western Australia and also the federal level. The permitting around the environmental front is very rigorous, and we have designed the project to minimise our impact as much as we can. So we leave large areas of standing eucalyptus woodland intact. We've designed our footprint so that we don't have to remove that, which is very important. I think that's important to the regulators, and I think it's important to the community at large and for us as well. We don't want to make more of an impact than we have to put this project into production.
Ausgold Executive Chairman John Dorwood speaking to Amelia Searson. And their target is to start mining and have their first gold pour by 2027. And in other mining news today, on the final day of the financial year, Mineral Resources announced it's completed the sale of its iron ore operations and assets in the Yilgarn region, northeast of Southern Cross. At the end of last year, MinRes ceased operations in the Yilgarn hub and exports through the Port of Esperance. About 800 people were redeployed to other roles within MinRes. And the amount the assets were sold for hasn't been disclosed. However, MinRes wrote down the value of Yilgarn from $90 million to zero in June last year. 3 minutes to one.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. Rain bomb. The east coast of Australia slammed by slow-moving, dangerous weather as flood-hit regions buckle down for more water and waves. A lively place in a time of war, the Al Baqa Cafe in Gaza, a beachfront hub for journalists and artists destroyed by an Israeli warplane missile, killing 20. And blue gums, native forests, street trees and botanic gardens. They all could be wiped out if one tiny beetle escapes Western Australia.
We know all about that, don't we? The borer. A couple of minutes to one here on the Country Hour, and just over 10,500 sheep sold at Mouchet this morning. Most lamb prices increased a little bit. Terry Birkin, hello. Can you run through the details?
Hi, Belinda. Lamb supplies remained solid with almost 9,000 this week as mutton numbers fell away to just shy of 1,500 head. Trade and heavy lambs were in good volumes and presented nicely through each agent. The buying field consisted of most of the regulars operating, as well as two eastern states buyers, plus the return of a major processor. Store lambs in particular again recorded gains along with the lighter grades of mutton. Store lambs again lifted $8 to $10, ranging from $71 to $176, while light lambs were firm to slightly dearer, selling from $132 to $187 a head. Trade lambs remained equal, selling from $150 to $192, and heavy lambs started from $180 up to a top of $269 for a pin of 30-plus kilogram carcass weight merino lambs with a fleece. Merino weather hoggets were making $82 to $135 for stores, and heavy bodies sold from $142 to $219. Merino ewe hoggets returned $111 to $168, while heavy crossbred hoggets range from $113 to $200, and likewise for younger rams, selling to a top of $200 a head. Light to medium weight mutton gained $12 to $15, with bone and grey selling from $90 to $163, and heavier ewes, regardless of weight, sold to a top of $200 a head. Heavy wethers made $150 to $230, while mature rams returned $40 to $150, depending on age and weight. This is Terry Bergen for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you for that, Terry. Just a few moments ago, you heard about one of the stars of the ABC TV show Master Dogs, Princess Annie, who died suddenly of a brain aneurysm this week, just age 5. And her handler, Frank, his wife died the week before. Annie has died this week. And on the text, I don't usually cry during the country hour, but that had me bawling. 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.